Joining me today, we have Dr. Nati Mdladla, Dr. Pinky Ngakani, and Professor Colleen Aldous to talk about ivermectin and its use in the prevention and treatment of COVID-19. We've seen the debate around ivermectin grow more and more passionate since the beginning of the year. Just by way of background, can you each just tell me how you became acquainted with ivermectin? Dr. Mdladla, you're at the top. Let's go with you first.
Thanks, Nadia. My first encounter with ivermectin was, as I've said so repeatedly before, was out of desperation in the second wave in our unit, where we saw a lot of deaths, especially in the young, that made me sort of try and look for something to change the disease pattern. And when I actually started looking for alternative cures, because back then I felt we were palliating everybody, just giving them oxygen, putting them on high flow nasal oxygen CPAP and ventilating them, and hoping that the body will sort itself out and patients will get better. And my feeling was that was not the right thing to do. And if there was something or anything that could actually be a treatment and change the course of the disease, I would like to find that particular drug. And that's when I actually then came across ivermectin as a treatment option. Obviously, hydroxychloroquine had died by then as an option for various reasons. And then I started researching ivermectin a bit more. I eventually got hold of ivermectin around about sort of late December. Obviously, then tablets were very scarce after SAHPRA had illegalized tablets for using COVID-19. And I got hold of the animal product. I started then using that firstly on sort of myself for prophylaxis from about December. And I got a farmer from our local area who came to the hospital to come and give me a bottle of 500 mils for patients after I read the article I'd written about ivermectin. So that bottle, I used it in January and February, sort of middle and towards the end of the second wave in Gauteng, on patients that I had admitted, who actually I all consented them and I told them what I was giving them and hoped that it would actually help them. So that was my first sort of proper prescribing of ivermectin in the clinical setting. But obviously, because that particular formulation was not registered, I was the only one who could actually do that for the patients, because obviously I couldn't expose my colleagues to that. So it was quite erratic. But in that process, I saw some dramatic improvement in some patients, and we actually discharged quite a lot of elderly patients that actually tried it on. Interestingly, one of them is actually, I've asked for consent, obviously, for mentioning the name, but the uncle of Minister Jackson Mtembu was one of the patients that we admitted around about January, February in our hospital. He was 78 years old and obviously fell out of the category of patients that we could resuscitate if he needed ventilation. Actually, we could not ventilate him. And his only option was something like that. And I actually remember I spoke to him in an evening and I said to him, well, I would like to ask you to try this. It might work. I don't know. It might not work. But it's the only option that you have at your age, because if you deteriorate, you're not going to ventilate or intubate you. But this gives you an option. And he said to me, give me anything. If it works, it works. And we put him on ivermectin over 5 days. And he actually made an improvement. As I speak to you today, he's alive. I had a conversation with him about 3 weeks ago. He's back driving and doing his normal work. And when he went home, actually he went home with sales of 61% when I sent him home. But he progressively improved and we put him on blood thinners and so on. But he's one of those success stories that happened in the second wave, January, February, that without that animal product that came from a farmer, probably, I do not know, he could have still survived or could have died. But that is not the option that one has, where you say you'll take a chance and see if the body heals itself or not. So, but I think with him, it really did make a big improvement.
Right. And Professor Aldous?
Okay, my interest has been as an academic. So last year, somebody asked me about it, and I did a quick literature search on it, and I found a few papers that didn't look good. This was around about October, and I rejected ivermectin as an option at that point. But then in December, a friend of mine told me that he was really sick with COVID, and he'd been given ivermectin tablets by a doctor, and he felt better so much faster. And as an academic, I thought to myself, well, you know, he might have been turning the corner anyway. Mm. Anyway, this is a very influential person who then got Pierre Corey to come and speak to a group of doctors and asked me to be on a panel to ask questions. And so my question to Pierre Corey was going to be, where is the research? Where are the meta-analyses? And in his talk, he actually gave them. And in his presentation, I realized, like many academics do, the passion actually puts an academic off, but he had the literature. And I decided to delve into the literature myself. And in that same week, SAHPRA came out with their announcement that ivermectin was not to be used and that it could kill somebody. And I knew enough in my reading about ivermectin to know that that's not possible. So there was misinformation there. And then when I looked at the NEMLC's document from December, I realized that they had not looked at the literature, because what I'd seen in a couple of days was far more than what they put forward in their rapid review at the time. And that is when Dr. Jacob Isak and I decided to start a group of doctors and researchers who were going to spend time involving ourselves with the literature to see where the truth was. And that's how my involvement has been. I'm not a clinician. I'm a scientist, but I've been following all the research.
And Dr. Ngakani, how did you first come across ivermectin?
Hi, everyone. Hi. I was introduced to ivermectin by a patient that I'd admitted to hospital. He was a 73-year-old gentleman who had diabetes and hypertension and admitted with severe COVID pneumonia with hypoxia. So I just asked him in passing, because I had seen ivermectin in the literature, but it out for a couple of patients, and then I was told point blank that it's not available in South Africa, so I forgot about it. But on the 22nd of December, I admitted a gentleman, 73, diabetic, hypertensive, hypoxic. And I just asked him in person, do you know anything about ivermectin? And he said, yes. In fact, my doctor wanted to prescribe it for me before I left, but then the ambulance got me to hospital before I could get hold of it. And then he asked his wife to come and bring it to hospital. And I just tried it out, because so I asked him, how did you get hold of this ivermectin? And he said, my doctor actually got it from any other skin conditions. This doctor was looking for skin conditions. So I decided, you know what, let me just try it out, because I didn't know that there was ivermectin available in South Africa at that time. So we tried it. Within 2 days, that gentleman was out of hospital, 73 with comorbidities. That was the first experience. So we admitted him on the 22nd, started ivermectin on the 23rd. On Christmas Day, he was home. Sets above 95%. For a person who came in with desaturation to less than 80%. For me, that was a very dramatic. I think maybe God wanted me to know, you know, and to trust this, because it was too dramatic. I don't get those reports, those results now all too often. That was the first patient I put on ivermectin. Then the second one, I asked them about ivermectin again. I need to say that these were mainly white patients, because the black patients were in hospital at the time. There were no relatives coming into hospital. Then they would ask me, so where am I going to get ivermectin? I'm like, just go find it. I'm going to give you the names of the places that sell it. Just go find it. Within 2-3 minutes, within a day, all my white patients would bring the ivermectin on board. My colored patients, sort of, but my black patients would still be, battling to get hold of it. I need to be honest here, because I've never shared this anywhere before. I had to buy it for patients, because I felt it's going to take time before they could get their hands on it. And we are running out of time. And just practically almost every single patient I put on ivermectin, I think I lost one patient around that time, because they always come to me too late in the disease spectrum. Because by the time they see me, we are almost out of the viral phase, which I feel that is where ivermectin is most active, even though it can still be active towards the end. But within that viral phase, we miss a lot of patients. And by the time they come to see me with hypoxia, it's usually far more advanced. But even at that stage, I used ivermectin to practically all the patients that I had. I would sneak it in as a drug, as if I'm smuggling drugs. But I wanted to make sure that each and every person would take it. And they took it and they felt better. Then I started using it on an outpatient basis. Friends of mine, family members of mine who would want to be on treatment, I'd put them on treatment and they would do very well. I've not had a single admission of all the patients where I started it outside of hospital. And I only had one death at the time from the patients where I tried, you know, relatively early on admission. So I found that it works, and it's difficult to unknow that. It's difficult to not trust that when you've used it.
And what does ivermectin do exactly in response to a viral infection?
It's an antiviral. It's got antiviral properties. For an example, when you're looking at the virus, there's a spike protein, which is supposed to dock or to get into the lock, if I may put it that way. It's like a key. The spike protein is like a key. And the virus has, I mean, the body has got the ACE receptor where it is, which sits like a lock. So for the spike protein to enter into the cell of a human body, it must first attach itself first to the sugar residual like receptors before it can fuse itself with the envelope of the cell of the person or the cell membrane of my body. And it uses the spike protein to do that. But it's a two-stage process. So it must first go to the sugar moiety, and then it must join, and then that is going to cause a configurational change in the receptor, which allows the ACE receptor to receive the spike protein properly, and then it gets inside the cell. When it has released the viral genetic material, even there, the virus, it needs to be paired together. I think Nati can come in here. It needs to be paired together to be imported to the cell where it is going to be, where it's going to transform the RNA to DNA using a reverse transcriptase, and then it joins or it amalgamates itself within the nucleus of the person so that it can be like a DNA virus, even though it's an RNA virus. In the long and the short of it, the ivermectin, it hinders the fusion or the entry of the cell, of the virus into the cell. It also hinders the transportation of the virus from the nucleus, from the cytoplasm into the cell, the nucleus of my body. It also has, I think it has protease inhibitor effects as well, where it delivers, where the virus, when it's supposed to be delivered or assembled, it also inhibits that process so that the virus doesn't become mature enough to be transported out of the cell to infect new cells. So in that sense, it does cause viral inhibition or viral death so that the cell does not multiply enough virus to infect more cells. I think that's it in a nutshell from what I understand. Yeah.
Thank you.
So just to add to that as well, so in simple terms, because I'm not sure actually who's going to be listening to this, is the first part of it is that, as Pinky said, it can bind to the ACE2 receptor, which is where normally the COVID-19 virus or SARS-CoV-2 virus binds to before it goes into your cell or before it goes to your body. So it goes into your nose, it binds to ACE2 receptors in the respiratory system, and then from those receptors it gets into the cells. So ivermectin actually binds and occupies those ACE2 receptors and prevents the virus from binding. So it means that it can't actually get in. So that's the first part. And the second part, as she rightly said as well, is an antiviral effect. So it actually is able to actually kill the virus. And for that, we're discovering that we need other agents to give with it to actually do that. So your zinc and your doxycycline are the compounds that we take together with ivermectin, because the zinc sort of breaks the shell of the virus and also allows then the ivermectin to get in and actually destroy further sort of your RNA material. The other effect, which is where most patients seem to talk about this feeling of getting better very quickly. It's a potent anti-inflammatory effect. So when you take it at the beginning, and most of the patients, actually hear patients say, I'm feeling very weak, I'm feeling very sick, sort of muggy, like there's a big cloud hanging over them, I can't move, and so on and so forth. It's because of the high inflammation that they're experiencing. When you give them ivermectin, within a few hours, and you'll get it very often with patients that you give to them when they're very sick, they'll tell you that I took the tablet at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and at 8 o'clock I was a different person. And that's because of this massive anti-inflammatory effect that it actually produces, which removes that sort of fog or cloud, and they actually suddenly feel better. And as a result, we actually often have to warn patients and say, when you get that feeling that you actually healed, don't get too excited and start doing silly things, because the following day, inevitably, you crash again. Mm-hmm. So just take things easy. And actually, most patients, I've had many testimonials about that. So that's a potent anti-inflammatory effect. And those effects, some of them, they actually persist sort of beyond that early phase of giving it. And that's why at times you can actually even use it for the for long COVID, because in long COVID, we think that it's actually the anti-inflammatory effect that it has that helps patients with long COVID to resolve their symptoms, because there seems to be this persistent long inflammation that goes on. And if you actually give ivermectin to patients who've recovered from COVID and now have the long COVID symptoms, it seems to actually work for that as well. And then obviously the other things, which probably where it improves oxygenation as well, is that by removing inflammation from the lungs and resolving your bronchospasm and so on, that might actually also improve the oxygenation. And as Pinky said, we saw, and we tended to see this dramatically in the second wave. And although we're still getting sort of good results in the third wave, the virus seems to either be resistant to this one, the Delta variant especially, or it's because of people using ivermectin on its own, especially without doctor supervision, that maybe they're actually experiencing resistance. And that is why we actually then actually insisting that it's actually not a drug to be used on its own. The combination with other agents and higher doses actually probably then achieves the same effect as we did in the second wave, and that's crucial.
The meta-analysis of the 21 randomized controlled trials by independent world-renowned researcher Dr. Tess Laurie came to the conclusion that reduced deaths by 80%. So for the layman, can you just unpack what a randomized controlled trial entails and also why Dr. Laurie's conclusions have not been universally accepted?
I can come in here. Dr. Laurie's was part of a team that did that ran that review, that meta-analysis. Mm-hmm. She was not the primary author.
Okay.
And they, in their study, and they used rigorous scientific methods. And I've come to the conclusion now that there are scientists who are pretty skullduggerous, and they are selecting papers based on a conclusion that they want to come out with. And the one trial that to me is the most honest is the Bryant et al. Paper, and Tess Laurie was part of that. Tried to round up a lot of people to try and do a good job of it. She had, I think there were 24 trials that they finally included, and initially they had included the Alcazar trial, which has been excluded now. So initially they said there would be a 62% drop in mortality. But taking out the Alcazar data, and remember the Alcazar data has still not yet been proven to be false. We might get that back. Having taken that out, the mortality rate, because the Alcazar data was so big, it's dropped to 49%. So according to their analysis now, we have a 49% chance of people not dying, which to me is still pretty significant. I mean, one death is too many. And if we can reduce those by half, that is there. So they have removed the Alcazar data, and we're down to 49%. The 80-odd percent that they had was for prophylaxis, but they only included three trials. So I would not look at that as enough to make a decision on.
And just to add to what Colina said as well, is obviously the data from trials, I know your question specifically towards trials, but I think what everybody also forgets is that when you look at what evidence-based medicine means, it's actually looking at the data from trials, and we combine that with physician experience, which is what myself and Pinky are talking about, is what we actually see in the clinical setting. And I agree with Pinky as well. It's probably the only drug that I've used in COVID-19, maybe actually except for antihistamines, which I've only started using about a month or 6 weeks ago, that actually gives you that dramatic improvement in patient symptoms and patients going home very quickly. So there is that component of clinician experience and observation, and also what patients think they actually need to take. Patients themselves weigh in. Evidence-based medicine combines the three: patient preferences, clinical observations, and what studies say. The studies themselves are not the only thing that dictates if a drug is suitable to be used or not. There are many things that we use in medicine at the moment that do not only have or do not even have solid randomized double-blind controlled trial level of evidence with meta-analysis to suit that for it to be used. But because clinicians' observations say it actually works and we've observed that, and patients feel that actually it helps them as well, then we actually go on and actually use it. As Colin has said, though, with the Tess-Lowry study, obviously there are people who actually decided what they want to believe and don't want to believe, and they'll actually formulate their own line of studies to align with what they want to believe in.
On that question, there's a CID study that was published in June that says that it did not reduce all-cause mortality. Is this an example of what you're referring to, that they had a conclusion that they wanted and they, you know, sort of found the evidence to match that?
One of our Yale colleagues has come and said the only meta-analysis or review that you can trust now is the one you do yourself. Because if you have a look at their inclusion and exclusion criteria, they are clearly aiming for a particular outcome. And that's really sad because evidence-based medicine looks at meta-analyses and reviews as having some sort of certainty. But there has been a lack of scientific integrity. And just getting back to evidence-based medicine, it's been around in its defined way since 1991 when David Sackett defined it. And the definition is to make a conscientious effort to look at the evidence that you have. It is not only randomized controlled trials. And when you see the data arranged into a pyramid, the lowest form of certainty is the doctor evidence, which is what we're seeing here. But when you've got hundreds of doctors coming up with the same outcome, you've got to start thinking about other studies. And there are plenty of other studies that are cohort studies, ordinary randomized control studies, observational trials. But importantly, there are also other studies that don't fall into evidence-based medicine, but they're on the safety and they're on the mechanism of action. And those are completely ignored by people who are only going on RCTs. And I'm beginning to wonder if we don't have a population of scientists who are actually science denialists when it comes to true evidence-based medicine.
Dr. Ndladla, Dr. Ngakani, do you guys have anything to add?
I can't hear Colin very well, but what I think we need to understand about the climate in which we are right now, we are in a time where we're looking for solutions. As Nadia has been saying, we don't want to wait until a patient gets to a state where there's nothing more we can do. When we have been given an opportunity to try and reverse the disease or stop the disease before it gets out of control. So when ivermectin came on board, at least to our attention, it offers to do exactly that. It offers to change the course of the disease early on. And it really reduces the number of patients that need to go on for admission to hospital as well as being ventilated and obviously from dying if you get the patients early. So the clinical trials, what they do then, they're supposed to clarify how this molecule works in this setup. They're supposed to clarify the dose that we need to use, what is the best dose to use, and not to try and prove that this drug works or not, because the drug does work. Even the person in the street knows that. So if you're going to be true to our patients and if you're going to allow our patients to still respect medicine, we need not be talking about the efficacy of ivermectin. We need to be talking about, you know, whatever else that scientists can bring to the fore that the patients don't know. Instead of us going back and forth trying to prove a point which has already been proven. Because what's going to happen next is people are going to bring molecules that are going to prove the same effects or maybe less or better, I don't know, than what ivermectin is doing. And that's going to sound so ridiculous for us to wait for somebody to come and bring something on board because they can now develop a new molecule. When we have got something existing at the expense of losing patients to death, we're losing parents, we're losing households, we're losing people to death just because we're waiting for somebody to come up with a new molecule that's going to receive the credibility. So the whole point about clinical trials was not to sabotage medicine. The point about clinical trials is to bring out and all understand and not have it. If the government was true to the cause of managing our patients, they would have long started the clinical trial themselves. Because if I'm telling you, if you're saying that patients are getting better, instead of arguing about how this drug works or how it doesn't work, we should just prove it. The government should have jumped to the bandwagon and said, let us now investigate and see how we can, you know, reduce the scourge of corona in our midst, instead of arguing on whether the drug works or not. The drug does work. And any sober person should really sponsor that. And we don't have the kind of money to prove that it works or doesn't or whatever, but we've got the clinical outcomes. So for me, the clinical outcomes are more important than the clinical trials at this point when it comes to corona, I mean, when it comes to ivermectin.
So the challenge right from the beginning, especially considering that we're in a pandemic, was with coming up with a cure that works very early on in COVID and prevents people from going to hospital. But when COVID started, and especially in South Africa, I was involved in Gauteng in the ICU part of developing strategies for COVID. What became clear was that there was hardly ever, and there still is no focus on actually avoiding people going to hospital. We were all worried about how many people are going to come to hospital, how to get the hospitals ready, sort of getting our oxygen supplies and so on, up to speed, ventilators and so on. And all of us, and nobody actually thought about, instead of trying to prevent the flooding of the hospitals, how do you stop the water from just coming out in the first place? How do you stop people from getting to a point where they get so sick that they actually need hospitalization? And we didn't think about this. And it was almost an option that was not available for the longest of time until this period in December when people started talking about these agents. So now agents like ivermectin, unfortunately, even when the WHO started studying drugs that we're going to be using COVID-19, is one agent that they actually left out. They studied a lot of modern agents, and only the anti-malarials, which is hydroxychloroquine, was added to that because maybe in Africa and some parts of Asia it would actually work. And ivermectin was only studied in parts of India, again in Asia, and South America. And WHO has sadly constantly overlooked this. And most of the agents that they were actually looking at, Solidarity, which was what WHO was a study that they ran, actually looked at in-hospital treatment still with the various other agents that they were looking at. And there was no investment at looking at how to treat this disease before people came to hospital. And it was countries that were actually very stretched in terms of hospitals that actually started looking at this option. Mexico, Chile at some point, Peru, and so on, that had to look at treating people out of hospital to avoid them getting to hospital as an option. And this is where actually ivermectin came out. So when I also started looking at it from the ICU point of view, what I realized was that in the hospital, you were dealing with a disease so advanced that your returns in saving patients were so low and disappointing that all that they achieved is actually stressing you as a treating physician. And what I wanted to look at, and I'm not a GP, I'm actually an ICU specialist, was I wanted to stop people from coming into hospital. And I've also gotten involved in out-of-hospital patient treatment like Pinky, just to, and because of all these presentations that one does on this, and patients started calling us and saying like, look, I've got COVID now, what must I do? And the one thing that makes sense is that there's no other disease that we've told patients to go home when the disease was mild and not a big problem, and they only come back when they're actually almost dying. We don't do that for cancer. We don't say to a cancer patient when they still have a small benign lesion or a localized lesion that can be excised, go home, come back when it's big and overgrown, and we'll cut it out. We don't do that. And we don't do that for other conditions as well, like ischemic heart disease and so on. We give them treatment. And only when the treatment fails and they come to hospital, then we actually go up. And for me, the question was, why are we doing this in COVID? Why are we telling people to go home while they still have mild disease instead of giving something that can treat them there and then? And hopefully a few of them then come back later on sick and not the majority of them. And many of us, like Pinky, I also have the similar stats of people that I've used this for in the outpatient setting, close to 100% haven't actually gone to hospital. Actually, I don't have a single patient who's actually been admitted to hospital with severe disease when they've actually started ivermectin well in time in the outpatient setting. And no mortalities or deaths related to that. So now these stories keep on coming up, and they're not fake stories. We are treating patients. So when I say this publicly, somebody, if somebody has actually failed treatment, they can come up and say, I lied about what I've said, because they know somebody that I've treated who probably then deteriorated. So for me, it was taking the studies, and actually the studies themselves, the studies that have come out in the outpatient setting, they give higher numbers of success and reduction in deaths than obviously late treatment, then and also then with in-hospital treatment. Your chances of success rate when people are admitted with severe disease in the hospital drops to below 50%, and that is even before the Al-Ghazal study was actually taken out. So for me, that particular evidence informed my decision to say, by the time they get to hospital, it's too late, and you're going to lose more patients. One in two are still a better number, and that's why actually when I consent patients, I say to them, I say, like, look, I'm not saying this is going to cure you definitely, but you have a 1 in 2% chance of actually making it with this than without it. If you don't get it, it means actually your chances are even less than that. So then I actually recommend that you actually take it. So it was a combination of that available evidence that informed my decision to get more involved now in out-of-hospital treatment. And in spite of all the negative media that's still out there, patients, which are the third component of the evidence-based medicine link, they still come to us and they say to me, I've been diagnosed with COVID and I'm ill. Can you please help me get ivermectin? Can you give me a prescription that will give me hope? And the reason patients are doing that, they've seen all the media around the drug and what's been going on over the last few weeks. But when it comes to their health and they make their own decisions, they make decisions that they believe will actually help them. And they do not sit back and say, I'm going to take my chances because I don't know if it's going to work or it's not going to work. Mm. They actually still go on it and we're still prescribing it even up to now. Mm.
Professor Aldous, 2 weeks ago you spoke to Alec Hogan. You said that it's not a miracle drug, but that it should be used as a cocktail in conjunction with other medications. Dr. Mdladla and Ngakani, what are your experiences in this regard?
So I can go first. So definitely it is not trying to prove a point. And I think some of actually the people that look at studies, when they challenge the studies that come out, they say, well, it was used with this and that. So how do we know if actually the drug worked or not? Mm. We know that it actually works, even on its own. With the original virus and maybe with the beta variant, it seemed to work well actually on its own. But we've learned that using it on its own might actually be creating, you know this from animals as well, resistance, which is what developed in animals that could have ivermectin on its own that has scabies or treated for scabies, is that over time you actually develop resistance. So if you use it with other agents, first of all, you avoid resistance in the long run, which means you have the drug available for you to use over many waves to come. And secondly, it's much more effective in actually treating the patient. And we're appreciating that even more now with the third variant or with the third wave of the Delta variant. And the combination of drugs is what actually Pierre Curie calls it doctoring. Sure. So we're not trying to prove a point. I want to see a patient go out. I have no allegiance to one drug or another. If there's something else that works better than ivermectin, I will use that. If there's something safer or whatever than ivermectin, I will use that. Right now, that's the one drug that we have. So we're combining with other things. And like I said, the two most important ones is zinc and doxycycline, just because that helps with viral killing and avoiding resistance. The other agents are supplementary and they do other functions. So I've started using in our ICU, we started using fluoxetine or to even my outpatients. I'll put them on either fluvoxamine and fluoxetine because it's proof in studies that actually complements it well and works well for COVID. And then we'll add things like vitamin C, vitamin D, for patients that are anxious or can't sleep at night, because one of the biggest killers for COVID is the fear factor has been created over time. And most patients, and you know this if you actually either thought you had COVID yourself or actually got COVID, is that when you get it, you think you have it, the amount of fear that you have can is on its own be detrimental. So oftentimes we'll try and actually give these patients something to actually make them sleep at night, either as a specific sedative like melatonin at night, which also has got other benefits as an anti-COVID medication, or we put them on antihistamines that can also have a sedating effect plus a complementary effect where they relieve the bronchospasm, which is what actually causes low oxygen levels and sets. On most of my patients, that actually would be the combination of drugs that I put them on. It's around about 7 or 8 different tablets that do different things, but all in all, sort of contribute to a positive patient outcome.
Does your experience and the fact that you support ivermectin, does that in any way affect your view on COVID-19 vaccination?
Personally, it becomes a bit of a challenge when you're talking about the vaccine as well as ivermectin in the same sentence. Because all we want is, like we have been saying, we want something that works. It doesn't matter where it comes from. It doesn't matter what it is. But all we want is something that's going to work for the whole entire, you know, spectrum of the disease. So the vaccines, it becomes a political issue when we stop ivermectin so that we can push the vaccine agenda. That's when it becomes a problem. But otherwise, vaccines generally have been used. All we want is something that's going to be effective against COVID, whether it's a vaccine or not a vaccine. Personally, I do not like the way that the whole ivermectin thing has been handled. And it makes me start questioning the legitimacy of the concept of what is going on behind the scenes. If we're going to oppress a drug and suppress a drug that we know should work, and then we push an agenda of something that we haven't got any confidence in, and all we're asking is for the same leniency with which the vaccines are being treated to be given to ivermectin.
And from my side, and I'll let Colleen sort of do the last part, is there is no world where the vaccines exist on their own or ivermectin exists on their own. And from the beginning, before vaccines actually came out, when we were using ivermectin in the second wave, December, before even the rollout came out, our prediction was that for the longest of time in South Africa, there were going to be people who would not be vaccinated by the time the next wave came, which was the one that we're experiencing now in winter. And the question was, for those people, and so what I said in February, March, so for people who will still not be vaccinated because the rollout is going to be slow, which we expected, and for people that might not be able to get the vaccine for various other reasons, and for people who actually get breakthrough infections with the vaccine, which also predicted was going to happen as variants actually came through, the question was, what would be the option for those people? A vaccine prevents disease. It does not treat disease. And there will be breakthroughs, and there will be severe breakthroughs. I've seen severe breakthroughs in my unit. I've treated a number of patients who've been fully vaccinated, who presented severe COVID, and have treated them with ivermectin. So for me, from back then, it was not a question of whether the vaccine should be used or not used. If the vaccine is obviously safe, it's effective, and it's used in the population of people that actually derive benefit from it, that vaccine should be used. And if the current vaccines fit that mold, then they should be used. But what do we do with people that can't be on them, people that still get breakthrough infections, and people that just plainly refuse to get them? And that's going to happen. It's happening all over the world. So for me, it was a question of when that time comes, there should always be a treatment available for those people. Because with or without vaccines, the treatment option is still available. And if some people then decide to take a tablet as prophylaxis, because that's the only option that they see viable, that option should be available. All that we need to do around both vaccines and tablets is give the appropriate education given by doctors to explain to people who either are taking the vaccine as treatment, because obviously I've had patients who, because they've been vaccinated, believe that it actually then will prevent severe disease and hospitalizations. And then they should stay home and not come to hospital until it's very late and they're very sick. A similar situation as people that probably are on ivermectin, who then also stay at home and believe that this is going to work and they're not going to go to hospital. So instead of squabbling about issues on both as if they're actually one agent against another, we should look at them as complementary treatments and educate people on when you are sick, this is what you must have at home. Have a pulse oximeter. Have this. Speak to your doctor regularly. Discuss how you're feeling on different days. And when things are not seemingly good and going the right direction, go to hospital on time, and that will save more patients.
Professor Aldis?
Okay, I've got to say up front that the two sides are not mutually exclusive, and the world is beginning to see that. And I'm going to read to you Pfizer's tweet from the 28th of July. Along with vaccines, success against COVID will likely require antiviral treatments for those who contract the virus. So they've already got a phase 3-2-3 trial going of an antiviral. Dr. Fauci, Anthony Fauci, last week said, we need a 7 to 10 day early treatment for infection of COVID before we get to the inflammatory response. And MSD or Merck Sharp and Dohme have got molnupiravir in their phase 3 trials. So it's been acknowledged that the two go together. And it's just a low blow from anti-ivermectin lobby to say that people who are advocates of the use of ivermectin to cure people are anti-vaxxers. We are most certainly not.